Our reading tonight is in Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2. The reading and exposition begins at verse 8. And this, of course, is the shortest letter to the churches, occupying in our version just 4 verses. Enough, I think, to keep us going tonight. Now, as has been our custom, I shall break it up as I read to you. Then, after I have read, I will give you leading ideas in each verse, and then we'll proceed to expound the passage. Now, verse 8, the revelation of the Lord. It always opens like that, each letter. The revelation of the Lord, verse 8. And unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive, the revelation of the Lord. Verse 9, the commendation of the Lord. I know thy works, and tribulation, and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews, and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Verse 9, the commendation of the Lord. Verse 10, the counsel of the Lord. The revelation, the commendation, now the counsel of the Lord. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried. And ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life, the counsel of the Lord. Verse 11, the promise of the Lord. The letters always open and finish the same way. The revelation of the Lord, closing with the promise of the Lord. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. The promise of the Lord. Now back to each verse. Verse 8, revelation. The revealing of Christ to this particular church. Verse 8, revelation. Verse 9, assessment. The Lord is assessing the church. I know the assessment of Christ. Verse 10, prophecy. Thou shalt suffer. The devil shall cast some of you into prison. Ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Prophecy. And verse 11, inspiration. Inspiring them to conquer. So we come to the church in Smyrna. Now, last night we indicated that there are three ways to view the churches. You can look at them as actual, literal churches, which of course we shall be doing. The second way is the way that most expositors and teachers take them, the prophetic viewpoint, in which they view Ephesus as the church of the apostolic era, then they go right down through history, and they finish at Laodicea at the present time. Then there's another way to look at the churches, which we shall be looking, and that is this. That each of these seven churches represent conditions that can be found in any church at any time. That's why we believe that he chose these seven particular churches out of all the churches in Asia Minor. Because there are conditions in these churches that can be found in principle at any time in any church. Now, these churches are looked upon as lampstands. You will remember that it is indicated, I turned and I saw seven golden lampstands. So that immediately you recognize that local churches are lights in each locality. Now you've got that. They are shining for Christ. The fact that they are golden suggests that they are set up in divine righteousness and are precious to God and Christ. Golden, set up in divine righteousness, and are precious to the heart of God and Christ. You see, when you come to your New Testament, local churches are the only unit of testimony. There's nothing else in your New Testament. Now, good to see things in their primitive apostolic setting. Again, you will notice that it's not a seven-branch lampstand like your Old Testament. It is seven lampstands on their own, indicating that every assembly divinely set up is responsible to God alone. They are not united like the seven-branch lampstand. No such thing as a confederation of assemblies in the New Testament. The reason is obvious. I'll repeat it again. In your New Testament, there are no such thing as denominations. No denominations to come out of, no denominations to go to. There were only assemblies as we know them, so there was no need for any federation. Confederation of assemblies are man-made. Now you may have your book. You may have your foot rule. Then that's your ideas. We're only looking at things as they're presented in the New Testament. No division of assemblies. Every assembly that was set up was the sole and single light in the area. That's why it was that God owned it. As I said before, not many things in one place, one thing in many places. Now good to see these things. And there that light will shine in the midst of all the darkness around. And it will shine for God and Christ. Now these are the ideas that God has associated with local churches. Good for you and I never to lose the primitive setting. If you get away from the primitive setting, you'll get away from primitive ideas. Never mind what men have produced. You hold fast to what your Bible teaches. Now, last night, we looked at the church in Ephesus, the only church of the seven that was set up by apostles. And we saw that Ephesus had quite a history. But when you come to verse 8, to Smyrna, you have no scriptural history of any kind. You come to a church now that was established by someone, person or person. How it was set up, we are not told. But tonight we are going to live in Smyrna. We are going to see what it means to have witness for Christ in Smyrna in those days. And we shall see that in 77 there are churches that are living in Smyrna. Now, we noticed last night that Ephesus on the prophetic side, now I'll only be just a minute or two on the prophetic side and I'll pass on. Ephesus was the apostolic era. Now, following the apostolic era,
There was a period of upward of 200 years when the church went through a baptism of blood. There were 10 persecutions raging against them, and the last of the 10 lasted 10 years. When the church was crushed under the heel of pagan Rome, thousands upon thousands of Christians were martyred and butchered and burned. Smyrna is a sub-form of the word myrrh. And myrrh was that aromatic resin that came out of the tree when the incision was made. So that it was a fragrant, bitter resin. And that fragrance, with its bitterness, was produced by wounding the tree. And so for well nigh 2 centuries, the church was wounded and bruised and crushed. Yet never did such fragrance arise to heaven as throughout those 2 centuries when the church went through its baptism of blood. And we find here, now we're on now not the prophetic side, we come now to a church that is suffering, and suffering deeply. Strange, isn't it? Strange. While they were all placed close together, none of the rest are suffering like Smyrna. That's strange. They're all in the same area. But Ephesus is not suffering like this, nor any of the others. So that localized in Smyrna, there was that which was crushing the church. Now we saw last night again that the presentation of Christ is directed to each church, particular. And very often, not always, but very often, the presentation of Christ is drawn from the vision of chapter 1. Thus in verse 8, the presentation of Christ to the church at Smyrna is the presentation that is given at the close of verse 17 and the opening of verse 18 of chapter 1. Now, the particular presentation of Christ will meet the need of the church at Smyrna. And if they can grasp and apprehend the vision of Christ and the presentation of Christ, it will enable them to overcome. For you see, in these churches you have to overcome to prove that you were real. Have you got that? The real Christians were the overcomers. But you couldn't sit back and fold your arms and cross your legs and say, well, I'm saved, I'm all right. Because you would prove your reality by overcoming. Have you got that? You see, in those local churches as today, there were unbelievers. People who are not saved. And the circumstances in the churches brought to light the people that really were. I've said before, a lot of our troubles coming from these people in the churches that are not converted. So that, here in Smyrna, the trial will be severe and prolonged to bring out the real. Now, as they are there in all, and please don't ask me, why Smyrna should suffer and the rest not. For the answer to that lies deeply embedded in the sovereignty of God. And I can't answer that. Why Smyrna and not Ephesus? I don't know. Why the underground church and not us? I can't tell. Maybe we're not worthy of it. Maybe we couldn't take it. Maybe too many of us would be exposed. But in his sovereignty at the moment, he has decreed otherwise. It's them and not us.
And when you get down to that, then away you go home and get down on your knees tonight and thank God that things are as pleasant as they are. And how much easier it is to live in Vancouver than in Russia or elsewhere. Now, to the suffering church in its baptism of blood that's going to increase, it's going to get worse. Christ says, verse 8, these things saith the first and the last. He that became dead and is alive. Now notice, Christ presents himself to this church as the first and the last, so that he is the eternal one. Look up. And in the midst of all your sufferings, grasp the fact that your Lord and mine is the eternal God. For the book of Isaiah three times draws attention to God as the first and the last. And Christ here takes the title, as he did in chapter 1, I am the first and the last. He straddles eternity. He's above and beyond all time. Things may happen down here, but the person that upholds you is eternal. The power of Christ can support any person at any time in any circumstance. I am the first, and you'll go back. And go back as far as you can. Ultimately, you'll reach Christ. Go forward. As far as you can, right beyond all time and away into the depths of eternity and ultimately beyond everything, Christ. Go back, and he's the origin and source and beginning of everything. Go forward, and he's the sum total and end of everything. For of him, through him, and unto him are all things. Christ that you know is the eternal God, the first and the last. There's nothing before Christ and there's nothing after Christ. More than that, he says, I became dead and am alive forevermore. Listen. You're going through suffering and a baptism of blood. I went the same road. I suffered. I died. I rose again. As the first and the last, my power will sustain you. And as the one who suffered and became dead and am alive forevermore, then you have all my compassion and companionship. For I tread that road before you. You're not asked to go through what I didn't go through. My brethren, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it? Ah, it's true. It's true that he became flesh. That's right. It's true, as we'll see later tonight, he became poor. But oh, brethren, the Lord of life and glory, the eternal one, the first and the last, he took a body that he might become dead. And then he broke the power of the tomb. And for 40 days he walked the virgin soil of resurrection, freshly planting his feet on soil that had never been touched before, and went back up to sustain his suffering people and help them through as he went through. Wonderful, isn't it? Verse 9. The commendation of Christ. Notice, brethren, will you? He has nothing to condemn. It's the same at Philadelphia. Nothing to condemn. The reason for that will become painfully clear to us tonight. No condemnation here.
Things are such at Smyrna that there's no soil for false apostles. And there's no soil for the doctrine of Balaam and Nicolaitans.
What is it? Verse 9. First of all, I want you to notice that the word works is absent in the best text. Leave it out. I'll tell you that in a moment why. Secondly, leave out the second expression, I know. And read like this. I know thy tribulation and poverty and the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews. Now notice the word works is out. He doesn't say I know thy works. Why? Listen, brethren and sisters. Now don't miss this. The suffering was so intense. The pressure was so severe. The need to survive was so ever present that they weren't able to do anything. They weren't able to do anything. Enough that they would get through. Enough that they would survive. Enough that they emerged. But the suffering is so terrible, they have no works. Go forward, will you? Aren't there Muslim countries today where they're not allowed to do anything? Aren't there places today where they're not allowed even to meet? Not allowed to propagate? Not allowed to preach? The suffering is so intense that they can only survive. That's all. Brethren, oh how we should value our liberty to work. These people couldn't do anything. They weren't allowed. The Lord says to them, I know three things. He says, I know thy tribulation. I know thy poverty. I know the blasphemy of those who call themselves Jews against you. Let's look at it. I know thy tribulation. I know the pressures that are on you. I know that you're being ground down between the upper and the nether millstones. This is the opposition of persons from without. I know all that you're going through. It's tribulation severe and protracted. It's crushing. That's the idea. It's like a huge boulder in a man's body. It's crushing the life out of him. I know thy tribulation. He's up there, but he says, I know all about it down here. I know thy tribulation. Look again. I know thy poverty. Now listen carefully. In the Greek, there are two words for poverty. There is the word that suggests that you've got enough. But only enough. That is, you work, you've got enough to see you through, but there's nothing superfluous. You've got enough. That's not the word that's used here. The word that's used here is this. I know thy destitution. They had nothing, absolutely nothing. They could hardly get a living, far less have anything over. It was sheer beggary. They were reduced beyond subsistence level. I know thy destitution. I know that you have utterly and absolutely nothing. You see, it meant something to be a Christian in Smyrna. Once they took the sacred name of Christ, they were finished. Pressure would be brought to bear on the employer to get rid of them. When the sheep came up for promotion and their name appeared, there's a mark against it. That's enough. You've had it. Right through, they're discriminated against. See, do you read intelligently your papers from time to time, the small little places? And you'll find that
freedom fighters and intellectuals over yonder in Russia and elsewhere are petitioning the government that believers should not be discriminated against. But they are. They are. Smyrna is being relived across the world. And in Smyrna, if you are a Christian, there's no promotion unless you give up your profession. You'll likely lose your job, and the only job you'll get is the job that nobody else wants. And then the cry would go up against the Christians. It would rouse the rabble crowd. And you can see it. Down they would sweep upon the folks who were known as Christians. They would wreck their homes, stone them. They would smash the furniture and steal their valuables. There you were, your home's gone. If your business there, the business is gone, and there's no compensation and there's no insurance. You've lost everything. You've no assets. And in the midst of plenty, you're desperately poor. And then you're despised for it. Say, brethren. So if they had a home, it was poor. If they had food, it was coarse. If they had a job, it wasn't secure. They'll never rise in the social scale. They'll never get anywhere. I know thy destitution. Brethren, away you go home, and thank God tonight that we live in the western side. And don't put too much emphasis on what you've got. I know thy destitution. 3. I know the blasphemy, the railing, the reviling. I know the reviling of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Would you notice something? I want you to notice that the opposition is stemming from the Jews. Now, they're not true Jews, for Romans 2 says a true Jew is a Jew which is one inwardly and not outwardly. If they had been real true Jews, they'd be Christians. You see, in those early days, it was the Jews that caused the trouble. For instance, do you remember in Antioch in Pisidia, when Paul was preaching, it says that, but the Jews stirred up devout and honourable women, chief men of the city, and raised persecution against Paul and Barnabas and expelled them out of the coast. That's Antioch in Pisidia. What? They went from there to Iconium, and here's what it says. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and made their minds evil affected against the brethren. And there was an assault made of both Gentile and Jew to use them despitefully. And they took it out. So they left Iconium and they went to Lystra. You remember what happened, don't you? There came Jews from Antioch and Iconium. Just when they had left, these Jews followed them. They persuaded the people and they stoned Paul and left him for dead. That was the constant thing. It was the religious folks that reared the persecution. And that's been true all down through the ages, isn't it? Our biggest enemies have been the folks that have claimed to know the same God. Interesting, isn't it? It's the synagogue of Satan. Now, if you go to your Old Testament, time and time again you'll read of the congregation of the Lord. The congregation of the Lord. The congregation of the Lord. But now, it's become the synagogue of Satan. And Satan's entrenched there. So in Smyrna, there's the synagogue. But it's Satan's. And there's the church and its gods. They're standing opposed to each other. Now I want you to notice an interesting thing now. For the first time in these letters, you've got the word Satan. Now watch. Now drop your eye, please. Verse 9.
but are the synagogue of Satan. Got that? Now verse 13. Now I want you to watch this one. I know thy works and where thou dwellest, even where Satan, not seat, where Satan's throne is. What do you think that means? Come on, brethren. What does it mean that Satan's throne was in Pergamos? Now I'll tell you tomorrow night what that means. It's a sinister business. But notice Satan's throne. Come now, please, the close of verse 13. Who was slain among you where Satan dwelleth. What do you think that means? Now I'll tell you tomorrow night. Come again. Verse 24. And which have not known the depths of Satan. See again? And if you go over to verse 9 or chapter 3, behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan. Same expression as 2:9. Five times, Satan, the adversary. Come back again to verse 10 of chapter 2. We'll deal with it in a moment. The devil. See the activity of evil? Oh, brethren and sisters, when are we going? When in God's name are we going to recognize that the devil's against us? Come on now. When are we going to waken up to the fact that the devil has set up his throne in certain places and the devil's working against the churches? Satan the adversary and the devil, verse 10, the slanderer. Now, come back with me, please, to the brackets in verse 9. I know thy poverty, but thou art rich. Ah, have you got it? I know thy poverty, but thou art rich. I want to talk to you about the riches of poverty. The riches of poverty. Strange, isn't it? When you go to Laodicea, it's the poverty of riches. The riches of poverty. Thou, I know thy destitution materially, but thou art rich spiritually. That's it. They had nothing, and yet they had everything. 1 Corinthians 1. Not many mighty, not many noble are called. God hath chosen the poor of this world. Isn't that right? The foolish. The base. The despised. James says, God hath chosen the poor of this world, rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom. Second Corinthians 6. How does Paul describe himself and others? Poor, yet making many rich. Eh? Having nothing, yet possessing all things. Oh, brethren, the glorious paradox of Christianity. The richness of poverty. Listen to this. What glory is it if ye be buffeted for your faults? Ye shall take it patiently. But if when ye do well and suffer for it, ye take it patiently, this is well pleasing unto God. For hereunto Christ also suffered for us, leaving as an example who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed all unto him who in the end would righteously judge. That's it. Smyrna, I suffered, I became dead, I went through to resurrection. Notice in Smyrna, they're suffering. They're not complaining. They're following the footsteps of him who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not. Wonderful, isn't it? Eh? The riches of poverty. Listen, brethren. Now listen. We've all got too much. That's our trouble. We've too much. We've too much. God knows we might be better men and women if we had a lot less.
I know thy poverty. Now, the same words are used as here for poor and rich. Ye know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, though he was rich, same word. Yet he became destitute, same word. That we through his destitution might be rich. Brethren, he became poor. So poor, that when he came to the inn where men are measured by what they've got, they rejected him. Oh, don't blame the innkeeper. The inn's the place where men are measured by standards. And you and I, if you and I had been the innkeeper, we'd have rejected him too. And in the hour of her greatest glory and the dignity of motherhood, she had nobody with her. She brought forth her son. No midwife, no nurse, no doctor. She brought forth her firstborn son on her own. God bless her. When she came to the temple, she brought a working man's offering of a pair of turtle doves and two young pigeons. Don't forget that your Lord and mine was destitute. He was poor. You won't forget that, will you? In the affluence of the 70s. Never forget your Lord and mine had nothing. Had to ask for a penny. Had to borrow a boat. Not right. The very tomb of lady's body and wasn't his. Brethren, he had nothing, yet had everything. That's where it started, in an outhouse, in a stable and a manger and a rough sweat floor. And when he left the world, he had nothing. Isn't that right? He even gambled for his clothes. Oh, the poverty. Yet the richness of poverty. Come again, please. Verse 10. Four things you'll pick out, won't you? Verse 10. Fearlessness. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Fearlessness. Two, imprisonment. The devil will cast you into prison. Fearlessness, imprisonment. Faithfulness, be thou faithful unto death. Reward, I will give thee a crown of life. Come again. He calls for fearlessness. He prophesies imprisonment. He demands faithfulness. And he promises a reward. The prophesying of Christ. Fearless, fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Brethren, it's not enough that they're destitute. God knows they've to go through more. It's not finished. Can you see it? Imprisonment. Suffering, imprisonment, death. Isn't that right? Suffering, imprisonment, death. It was like that for this reason. That in that old time world, when you were thrown into prison, the state wasn't responsible. If nobody brought you anything, you just died. You were as good as dead when the door closed on you. Can you wonder now that Paul talks about Onesimus refreshing him? Saved his life. Thou shalt suffer. Oh, I can understand. Say, you could understand the ungodly suffer, but why should the godliest of all suffer? Hebrews 12 will help you. Whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth and scourgeth. The words are not mine. Scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. So that whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. Chastening is a proof that God loves me. He scourgeth every son. Chastening is a proof of sonship. Now he says, listen, don't you be afraid of the things that thou shalt suffer. It's going to get worse instead of better. Look again. The devil shall cast some of you into prison that you may be tested. Oh, God knows, were they not tested enough? Had they not been tested enough? Was it not enough to be destitute, Lord, without throwing us into prison?
I says, listen, the slanderer shall cast some of you.
The devil would slander them to other people
and get them on false charges thrown into prison.
The gates would open and close.
Now he says, when that happens, don't be afraid. Well, that's just when you would be afraid, wouldn't it? Say, the knock came to the door and they took you away and put you into prison on false charges. That's when you would get frightened. Ah, but listen.
Listen, the road has been trodden before. Wasn't Joseph there? Come on, Darren. Wasn't Jeremiah there? Wasn't Peter there? Wasn't Paul there?
The other Smyrna saints are there. There's thousands have been there. They've known the door to close behind them. Fear not. The devil shall cast you into prison, that you may be tested.
Ye shall have tribulation 10 days.
Now in the apocalypse, I would interpret literally, if it is possible, on every occasion. Unless it's ridiculous to interpret otherwise. So it possibly means 10 days. To widen it out, it would indicate that the time would be short. Ye shall have tribulation 10 days, not another minute. After that, it's controlled by Christ. Now he says, I'll tell you how long you'll be there. And they'll not be able to keep you another minute. My, that's good, isn't it? Eh? Look again, please.
Be thou faithful unto death. Faithfulness. Right on to the gates of death.
Is interesting. You see, I'm quite convinced about this, please. That if ever you and I had to face death, that grace would be given to die. And I'm quite clear about that. At the moment, what you and I need is grace to live in Vancouver.
Faithful unto death.
Oh, yes. Yes. You know, you've heard of the early church father called Polycarp. He was the bishop of Smyrna. And the cry got up as oftentimes it did against the Christians, and they cried for the blood of godly Polycarp. He was asked, now, say Caesar is Lord and you're free. Maybe more about this tomorrow now. Say Caesar is Lord and you're free, but the old man can't do it, for he believes that Jesus is Lord. Well, you know what it's going to be. You'll burn. And here's his testimony. 86 years have I served him, and he has done me no harm. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me? And he went to the flames. Faithful unto death. Over yonder in the south of Scotland, there's a monument to two women. One older, one younger. It has been decreed that they'll die by drowning at the stake. They placed the older woman further out and the younger woman near the shore. They were asked to recant their faith in Christ, and the older woman refused and died singing. Strange how the martyrs never died grimly, they died singing. And the younger woman's watching it. Oh, it's hellish, isn't it? The water came and lapped her ankles, to the calf of her legs, to her hips, to her chest, to her chin. Still she refused. The water went over. Then the soldiers rushed in, and they lifted the stake above the water and gave her one last chance to recant. What would you have done? Come on, what would you have done? She refused and died for Christ and his church. Wonderful, isn't it? Eh?
good number of years ago, five young men looked out across the river to the Oka Indians. No question of suffering now, just a question of the will of God for them. Some are wives and families. They gather that it's God's will to take the gospel to the Oka Indians, and they flew over. They never came back. They'll find their bodies floating in the river, faithful unto death. There have been missionaries recently, not with assemblies, but we just don't do everything. And they have died, martyred and butchered for Christ. Be thou faithful unto death. No talk about salvation out of it. No promise that I'll miraculously deliver you. Just you keep on suffering and be faithful unto death. And I will give thee the crown of life. Go through what I went through. And on the other side, it's life and not death. Now I want you to notice something. I want you to notice that at the end of verse 10, that's a promise to the martyr, not to the overcomer. Got that? It's a promise to the martyr, not to the overcomer. Why? Because all martyrs are overcomers, but not all overcomers are necessarily martyrs. They weren't all asked to die. Some of you. And I will give thee the crown of life. Verse 11. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. You'll go through this one, but not the next. You'll experience this, but you know, in my company, it's really nothing. At its worst, it's only the separation of the soul from the body. Never shall the second death touch you, the separation of the person from God. You'll emerge on the other side into life, glorious and supreme. Yonder in that place of life everlasting. Life supreme, life glorious, life preeminent, life celestial, life immortal, life eternal. You shall reign with me. The second death. Into the lake of fire from which there is no exit, you shall never know. And as the flames surrounded them, burned them to ashes, they went through in triumph and in victory, assured that life supreme waited to greet them on the other side. Listen again. I know thy tribulation, for I went through the pressure too. I know your poverty and destitution, for I became poor and destitute. I know the blasphemy and the railing and the reviling of those who oppose, for they oppose me too. I know what it is to suffer. I feel for you. I know what it is to be taken to prison and judgment. I know what it is to be faithful unto death. I know. I understand. I appreciate, I value, and I'll give you everything in recompense. Farewell, Smyrna. Farewell. We might never walk the same road. We might never know the blackness to become more dark. We might never know the waters to run deeper. We might never know the fire to burn more fiercely.
But, oh, Smyrna, we've learned to appreciate the glory of your suffering, the wonder of your dying, the glory of your resurrection. Smyrna, we'll try. We'll try. Maybe not in the same plane as you, but we'll try
to live a wee bit more for you here, where there's no suffering,
there's no imprisonment, and there's no real faithfulness called for,
and there's no crown of life awaiting us, for we'll probably never be martyred.
But we'll try and follow a little behind you until the race is run, until the journey's done, until the crown is won.